From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Hit the internet in China, and you are through the looking glass. Everything familiar, but different. Alibaba for Amazon, Baidu for Google, Tencent for Facebook, sort of. Now Alibaba is coming to the U.S. for an IPO. China's Twitter, Weibo, is right behind. That's interesting in itself, but it's the morphing of American prototypes in China that's really fascinating. This hour On Point, China's internet giants and the web world they create. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you know this world? Tell us how it's like and unlike the internet USA style. Will it change China? Will it change the web? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's go to China. Joining me now from Beijing is Gadi Epstein, China correspondent for The Economist, former Beijing bureau chief for Forbes magazine. He's covered the Chinese tech sphere in a big way. Gadi Epstein, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
And with us from Hong Kong is Lily Kuo. She's emerging markets reporter for Quartz, Atlantic Media's online business and economics publication. She knows China inside and out. Lily Kuo in Hong Kong, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Gadi, first to you. Why is Alibaba, and this is sort of like China's Amazon, but all these things have different pieces now. Why is it coming to the United States for an initial public offering, to go public?
Well, it's the second part that Alibaba has listed. The first time they went public with Alibaba.com, a piece of the company, was in Hong Kong. And then they took that piece of the company private and now going public in the U.S. And that's because since they went public with Alibaba.com, they really built their version of eBay, or Amazon, as you like, mm-hmm. Taobao, which has become absolutely dominant here. And now they have a chance to turn that into a big listing in the U.S. And Jack Ma, the founder of Alibaba, I think has expressed an interest in listing in the U.S. over Hong Kong, in part because of the difference in rules and how you can separate the shareholder classes. So the founders and the group around Jack Ma can maintain control of Alibaba better in the U.S.
And Lily, they're looking for a big dose of capital here. They're talking about raising maybe $15 billion, a valuation of $100 billion plus. What do they want to do with the war chest that would come from this IPO?
Well, there's a lot of things Alibaba is trying to get into, and I think that's one of the reasons why these Chinese tech companies are so interesting. So for a long time, you had, you had three big tech companies, big Chinese giants that had their own sort of spheres of influence. So Alibaba had e-commerce, they had Taobao, and other sort of e-commerce related products. But now Alibaba wants to sort of go up against other firms like Tencent, as you mentioned, which is really into social media and messaging apps. And then also, so I think that Alibaba will use that money to expand into mobile payments, e-commerce on mobile services, and also social media.
Mobile, huge. Social media, huge. They're like elsewhere. Gadi, lay out the original kind of big three in China and how they paralleled American prototypes. And then here Lily says, and everybody says, now the walls are all coming down. Everybody's competing with everybody. But where did this begin? Where is it headed, Gadi?
Well, it started in the late 90s. You have basically what's called BAT, Baidu. That's the Google of China, started by Robin Li. Alibaba, which we just discussed. Mm-hmm. And Tencent, founded by Pony Ma. Also in the late 90s. And Pony Ma started with a version of ICQ, really a copy. And all of these folks started with copies of Western internet products. And then they built on top of that. And Pony Ma might have been maybe the first to just build a huge user base on no revenue. Alibaba.com did that too. And then layer more services on top of that. And Tencent did that successfully first. And just with a huge user base of hundreds of millions of users of this QQ kind of instant messaging service, kind of like AOL Instant Messenger, they started leveraging that into other markets like online games. And they were also early players in any other field that startups would get excited about, whether it was online video, shopping, and then microblogs. They would come in, Pony Ma would come in and invest heavily in. And I would say the rest of the internet was quite afraid of him if he decided to get into a business line. And that's sort of what we are seeing now in Weibo and Alibaba going public and raising more money to do battle with him.
Weibo as in China's Twitter.
That's right, China's Twitter, Sina Weibo, which Tencent has a version of. But more threatening to Sina Weibo is Tencent's WeChat, which people have described as kind of like WhatsApp in America, but it's more like WhatsApp on steroids. It has a lot more functionality and has really grown in the last year tremendously. And Sina Weibo, which has been the main Twitter, really, of China, has seen its usership and engagement decline a bit this year as WeChat has really risen in popularity.
Lily, put us in the shoes or fingertips of a Chinese internet user who's looking out at this array of big services there. Compare it to the American experience, where we're dealing with Amazon, Google, Facebook, Twitter. How's it like and unlike the American experience of the internet using these big Chinese players and their spinoffs, Lily?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of differences. One thing that is, online shopping seems to be much bigger in China, and also it's expanded. It's kind of also a way for shoppers and consumers and, you know, rising middle-class families in second-tier and third-tier cities to buy kind of anything they want to buy in China. So you've got a lot of online shopping. And one thing that's different, I think one of the reasons why Alibaba has become so big is because of its third-party payment system, Alipay, which was key to getting Chinese consumers able to trust online shopping. And one of the reasons why Alipay became so popular is because it's actually not very easy in China to buy things with a bank card or debit card. So a lot of people actually end up using Alipay. And one of the reasons why I think that there is this sort of collapse in these barriers between these big three Chinese companies is because of the shift in internet users to mobile phones. So more people now are getting online through their mobile phones. And because of that, it's like, I guess you would say Chinese consumers or Chinese internet users or cell phone users, you know, they're not necessarily using the same companies that they used to use on their desktop to shop online or to chat with their friends. So now WeChat is really big on cell phones. Alipay is still big on cell phones, but not as big as it is on your desktop. So I think that it's actually because of mobile phones that you have so much competition now.
I want to look at everything that's going on there. That's a mouthful. But Gadi, just the broad experience of using the internet at China through these giant companies, Alibaba and more, how do you find it, like and unlike the American experience of engaging the internet?
I think people jump to the internet much more here than in America, much more quickly. One of your questions in the intro was whether it has changed China or is changing China. It absolutely has changed China. I mean, Taobao, just to give you an idea of its influence, a majority of the parcels delivered by courier in China on any given day are generally going to be due to Taobao purchases.
And this is Alibaba's kind of Amazon equivalent, the online
retail.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Say that again. The majority, what?
The majority, you know, this statistic can vary 50% to 60% of parcels delivered by courier would be attributable to purchases for Taobao. And this has been true off and on for the last couple of years or more. And it's just an astounding figure. People, if they decide they need something, they're going to purchase it first, either on Taobao or on this kind of up-and-comer JD.com that Tencent has invested in, their rival has invested in. People shop online first, and I think they've skipped straight from bricks and mortar, you know, skipped the step of bricks and mortar. As Lily was saying, in second and third tier cities, there just aren't necessarily these retail outlets at times.
I mean,
and people just go directly online.
This is kind of mind-boggling. I mean, we hear all the time in this country about how huge Amazon is, and that's in an American context, basically. Here's China, a much larger country, and you're saying that their online retailing is even bigger there, and why is that again? Because they didn't have the built retail infrastructure, so it's just gone straight to point and click and buy?
That's absolutely part of it, and it's also, as Lily said, the advent of payment services like Alipay that has made it very easy to do so. Then there's people who've gone on to Taobao as sellers, millions of people who sell on Taobao as well. It's a flourishing marketplace. At the same time, social media has also transformed China in a different way. It's the first time that they've had a public square where people can speak to each other directly and broadcast information. And, of course, China cares about controlling that and does censoring and filtering. But it's a huge change from a decade ago. And there's no comparable in the U.S. because, to have in an open society, it doesn't mean as much to have Twitter But in China, it's quite a big deal.
Lily, what about the vibrance of that social media sphere? Americans think of China as quite censored. But if you're in China, you're Chinese, you're using that. Does it feel circumscribed or does it feel open?
You know, I think that's the beauty of Chinese censorship is that it's not so obvious that it's obvious, but it's just inconvenient. So it's just inconvenient enough that your average internet user doesn't try to get to sites that they can't get to, or they don't really notice that certain things don't turn up search results or don't turn up complete search results. But on Sina Weibo, which is sort of like Twitter, there's so much content on there that I guess people just don't really notice that sometimes things are scrubbed or that the results are being censored. But there's also just a lot of different forms that people use. So you can pretty much, you know, kind of say what you want to say, and it might get wiped in a few hours, but it also, you know, does get around pretty quickly.
Also, big differences. I'm reading here about somebody putting recently given a 10-day jail sentence for something that they, in the effect, tweeted, or the equivalent, about the Malaysian Airlines flight, about a rule here that anyone who posts a false claim that got reposted 500 times could go to jail for 3 years. Got similarities and we've got big differences. It's changing China. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about China's internet giants, Alibaba, Baidu, Tencent, and the alternative internet universe on the other side of the world. Alibaba now preparing for a big IPO in the United States. Lily Kuo from Quartz joining us today from Hong Kong. Gadi Epstein with The Economist in Beijing. Here's an Alibaba ad. This is back all the way back in 2009, but boasting here, Alibaba, of the company's reach in the global market. English version.
What do buyers look for when they seek out suppliers across the world?
I want the best price.
Reliability, product safety.
Business reputation.
Buyers all around the world are finding what they want on Alibaba.com. Alibaba makes it easy for small businesses to profit from the boom in global trade. Alibaba.com is where smart buyers find suppliers online.
Alibaba with international outreach there, but the real action is at home in the huge Chinese market. Here's an ad from the popular Chinese instant messaging service, Tencent QQ. The ad follows the story of a mother and a son who live far away from each other in China, but are nevertheless connected by Tencent.
不论母亲离我有多远,谈指间,
no matter how far my mom is from me, with a click of the fingers, I feel she's right by my side. It's an ad a lot of Americans could identify with. Now, Alibaba coming to the USA for a big public offering. Gadi, Lily, please stand by in China, Hong Kong. Susan in Akron, Ohio. Susan, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. I discovered AliExpress, which is in some way related to Alibaba. It allows you to make much smaller size purchases. I purchased about 6 different things off of AliExpress. The service has been fantastic, great email communication with the company, and oftentimes free shipping, great tracking services, and now it's my first go-to when I'm looking for certain items.
Wait, Susan, so you're in Akron, Ohio, and you're using a Chinese online retailer to buy online?
Yes.
Why not Amazon?
Well, because at this point, I'm specifically looking for party items for an Asian-themed party. And when I Googled certain items, AliExpress came up, and I found exactly what I was looking for. And the prices are fantastic. I've even chatted live with a seller about a particular product. Great feedback, great communication, free shipping, great tracking of shipping.
Susan, I appreciate your call. Gadi Epstein, this is kind of blowing my mind. I mean, at least when Walmart outsourced and bought everything in China, we had an American middleman who was making some kind of money here.
Right.
Now, Susan is buying directly from China. Is this a big part of the game plan or not?
Well, it's a piece of the game plan. I think it's small by comparison to Taobao and the other business lines that Alibaba is going in. But it certainly was Jack Ma's original vision, was to connect American buyers with Chinese sellers. That was how he started the company. With just 19 people back in the late 90s with basically one computer. And it was a dream before most people in China had any idea what e-commerce might entail at all. He sort of invented this this aspect of the business, and then he built the rest of Alibaba on top of it.
Lily Kuo, I can imagine Americans listening saying, oh, you got to be kidding. I mean, this takes away the last little middleman between American buyers and Chinese producers. Is this a sideline for China, selling into Akron, Ohio, and the rest of the country? Or it must be a fraction of what they're doing at home.
Yeah, the Chinese e-commerce market is huge. And just talking about AliExpress, it just made me, and the reach all the way across America, it just made me think about Taobao's reach across China and these Taobao villages, which are these small villages that have basically turned into hubs for either selling particular products or catering to the e-commerce business in that village. And they actually call them Taobao villages. And there are these, you know, slogans in different villages saying, you know, have you shopped on Taobao today or not? And you should.
I've got listeners online here saying, great, they can sell back to us all the technology they've stolen from us since Reagan was president. This listener then says, Alibaba isn't even Chinese. They stole that from the Persians. Gotti, originally there was a lot of, well, I mean, it's just straight up prototyping is one way to put it. The American mm-hmm. models were sort of originally embraced wholesale and recreated in China. How far is the morphing going? How are they like and unlike now, their American sort of original models?
They're morphing a lot now. And at the beginning, that wasn't the case. There was a lot of just straight out copying. The market was big enough that you could just do that. And there would be multiple copies fighting it out. I once did a profile for Forbes of a guy I called the cloner. He did copies of, very good copies of Friendster, Facebook, Twitter, and Groupon. And two of those became quite successful. Facebook clone RenRen is sort of the Facebook of China, the more classic Facebook mm-hmm. model, as opposed to the hybrids that Tencent and Sina have created. And the Groupon clone is one of the top ones in China. And he just basically made copies. And that was the business model for a long time. But folks like Tencent, Alibaba, have shown that you can also innovate on top of that. And the online video experience here, while it started as really just copying YouTube, is now completely different. And that's partly because the market for television here is very different from in America, where here there's heavily censored television. Now people go online and they can see things that they might not be able to see, or they definitely cannot see on state television.
We took On Point to Shanghai a few years back and talked to a very high Chinese Communist Party official there who said, look, you know, right now the United States dominates the internet, but eventually China will, because we have the numbers. We have such an enormous market that what we do will become the template. Do you see that happening, Gadi? Do you see China now prototyping and the potential that U.S. companies will be following in terms of services, how companies are structured, how services are arrayed, Gadi?
Well, I certainly think that folks in America would like to see to duplicate WeChat's success. WhatsApp isn't quite there. And some of the things that WeChat have done with the way that they can make their service more interactive and diversified is something that I think people in America would like to achieve. In general, America has done a very good job of innovating, and I don't think that we're at that stage yet. But China's doing much better than it has in the past on innovating in processes and in product.
Leslie in Waubun, Massachusetts. Leslie, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to let you know that the new technology has really made a difference in my life. My son lives in China, has lived there for 12 years, and in the beginning we had not phone calls intermittently. Sometimes we could Skype, again, intermittently. But since WeChat has come on board, we're really in communication on a regular basis. In fact, this morning at 10 o'clock, I called him on WeChat or voicemailed him. He gets it on his phone, and he can tell me where he is, what he's doing, and we can have a short conversation, and I can get to hear his voice, which is so wonderful, because
sure.
Once you're that distance away from your son, it's hard to get information and know how he's doing.
WeChat, the Chinese product, of course, and how do you like it compared, let's say, to Skype, the American product, Leslie?
Well, the problem with Skype is you really need a tremendous amount of bandwidth, and that's fine when I'm at home and I'm on my Fios Verizon. But sometimes when I'm just out and, you know, bumming around and I'm thinking of him, I want to let him know that I am curious as to where he is and what he's up to. And so WeChat is just a real quick, fast way of getting in touch with him. I can just hold my button down at the bottom and send him a voice message, and he responds immediately. It's much better. I also get to see his pictures. He posts them, and I can have a record of his voice, so I can save it and keep it for a while.
Leslie, with direct experience there, using the Chinese product to talk to her son in China, I mean, Gadi, is this part of the reason that Facebook went for WhatsApp? Are they looking at global competition around that kind of interaction?
Well, I think Facebook's also worried about, of course, domestic competition,
yeah,
and wouldn't want Google to buy WhatsApp either.
Mm-hmm.
I think WeChat will be one of the more successful of the Chinese products to go overseas, and that's part because China's such a global player now that if you want to be in connection with anybody in China, you got to be on WeChat. I do think that there'll be limitations to that growth, in part because of trust. These are Chinese internet companies that play by the Chinese rules, including the Communist Party's rules. And I think there will be some inherent trust limitations for as people use these products for things besides just buying party favors.
Jerry in Brewstertown, Tennessee. Jerry, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Tom. I think it's very interesting that the name comes from Aladdin, and it being a private held company in China with the communist leadership, how can anybody really know what they're really accomplishing versus what the state is actually supporting?
These are interesting words, accomplishing and supporting, but let us look at that relationship between the state and these companies. I appreciate your call, Jerry. If I may, let's go to Shanghai right now. Tom Doktoroff joins us. He's J. Walter Thompson, Asia-Pacific Advertising Agency CEO, marketing and advertising expert. Tom Doktoroff, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We talked a long time ago in Shanghai now. Everybody's thinking about Chinese internet companies because you've got Alibaba looking for the American IPO, and you hear the American caller there saying, what's the relationship between these companies and the government? If you're a Chinese user, can you trust these internet companies in the what we like to think of as the American style? If you're an American user, can you trust? What about this relationship, Tom? Big companies do come face-to-face, or more than that, with the Communist Party in China. How's that work?
Well, it's a very codependent relationship. The internet companies exist by the grace of the central government, and they have entered into a mutually beneficial arrangement. I always think of the internet in China as a manifestation of the Chinese government patriarchal benevolence. It's created, as The Economist magazine called it not too long ago, a giant cage. And that giant cage is much bigger than anything that existed. So from the perspective of consumers, they're much freer than they used to be. It is a blank canvas of self-expression. And yet from the government's perspective, they are able to keep a much closer ear, you know, on what is happening. And in some ways, the internet and the 100,000 internet cops are the greatest polling revolution that the Chinese have ever seen. So I think that it's a mutually beneficial and codependent relationship.
Lily Kuo, others are saying here that the internet, these big companies in China, yes, there's been a government role, but there's been a lot of private enterprise or initiative taken here too, and that simply by offering alternatives to old ways of doing things, these internet companies could produce a kind of new revolution in consumer behavior, maybe even in political interaction in China. What do you say to that, Lily?
I think that Sina Weibo is a platform that had a lot of potential, and people talked about Chinese politics even in terms of the post-Weibo time period. So the latest leadership transition, people said this is the first one that's taken place since Weibo, since people are posting news, posting comments very quickly, and it's being circulated very quickly. But I think that what's happened over the past year since Xi Jinping has come into power and has launched a sort of crackdown on social, on online discussion, and in relation to that arrest that you talked about, these rules against spreading rumors online and that you can be arrested for them, and shutting down the accounts of big people who had very large public followings. I think that that campaign has shown that the government, in the end, really does have a tight hold over the internet and over expression online. There are still, because of the nature of the internet, these voices still do get out. So, you know, there are limits to how much control there is, but the government still does have, still does maintain quite a bit.
Gadi Epstein in Beijing. In the United States, we've heard a lot about just the intrinsic power of the internet, the structure of it. Once you have it, it works against centralization in some ways. What about this? Do you see ultimately these big Chinese internet companies, even if the government is involved, are there fundamental dynamics that change markets that may even change politics in China, Gadi?
That's obviously a great long-term possibility. It's a significant possibility. My argument in A Giant Cage, and I'd like to thank Tom Doctoroff for
the reference there, yeah,
is that that probably the Communist Party has extended its ability to rule by embracing the internet in the way it has, by embracing it and controlling it. And we've gone this far in this hour without, I think, explicitly talking about the Great Firewall of China, in which, you know, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube are all blocked in China, and that's part of the reason that they can kind of successfully lord over the existing Chinese internet companies with more success, with bigger reach. All of these companies, Sina, Tencent with both Weibo and with WeChat, they all cooperate with the Chinese government on self-censorship, and it's in their interest to do that. And the same goes with online video companies. It's in their interest to cooperate because there's such a big market for them to tap into here. And that's one of the points that when you were talking about why they're getting into each other's businesses, I think it's important to stress. It's a huge market. It's big enough for several winners in each of these business lines. Over 600 million users, twice the population of the U.S., online in China. And it's a market worth cooperating with the government to take advantage of.
Tom Doctoroff, can you imagine? I mean, here we have the big players in China getting into each other's businesses, as Gadi says. Is that a dynamic that could translate to the American internet market, where we've had, you know, would have Google suddenly really get into Amazon's face and on and on and on?
Well, I'm not an expert on the dynamics of the American internet market, but what I will say is that in China, competition is usually managed, and I think that each internet company is going to develop its area of special expertise before too long, because the benefits of scale and managing scale in China are difficult to replicate. So I think that for the first time now, you're seeing the primordial seas taking shape. And you know, what WeChat is going to be deepening its expertise in terms of WeChat and group chatting. And Tencent is Tencent. So I do think that the seas are taking shape right now.
Lily, I've just got to ask you, Tencent, it sounds like an American hip-hop group. Is that clearly English to Chinese readers or listeners? I mean, it's 10 cents,
yeah,
like a dime, okay. Like 10 cents, but yeah. 10 cent, right?
Right, it's Tencent. Yes, it does sound a bit like Chinese English. I was just reading about names of names, so Alibaba, where that name came from, because I mentioned it to my boyfriend the other day, or we were talking about Alibaba, and he was like, you know, whenever I hear Alibaba, I think of Aladdin. But Tencent, I mean, so QQ used to be, it was named very similarly to ICQ, and then they just changed it to QQ, and WeChat is based, the English name of their messaging app is in English approximation to Weixin, which is what it's called in Chinese. But for Tencent, I'm not sure actually where the origin of that name comes from.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about China's internet giants, Alibaba, Baidu, Tencent, and the alternative internet universe on the other side of the world. Lily Kuo is with us from Quartz in Hong Kong today. Gadi Epstein with The Economist out of Beijing. And Tom Doctoroff is here from J. Walter Thompson in Shanghai. Alibaba coming to the United States for its IPO. There's a lot of excitement about that. It is expected to be very big. Here was Jim LeCamp on Monday, Senior VP at Macro Portfolio Advisors, telling CNBC that Alibaba's pending IPO shows the resilience of the U.S. economy.
The fact that they chose New York is a change from what we've seen over the last 10 years. We've seen a lot of big IPOs go to London, go to Hong Kong, China. This is a Chinese company coming over here. So I think this is a real positive for and a positive sign that the U.S. market is again seen as more resilient, more innovative, more nimble than the rest of the global community.
Gadi Epstein, do you buy that explanation for why Alibaba is coming to Wall Street for its IPO?
No, I think they're coming to Wall Street for the money, but also for the ability to maintain control by the founders of each of these companies because of the shareholder structure they can get here, get in America as opposed to Hong Kong. The money is deeper in America. The institutional investors, the average investor, there's a lot more of it there. In that sense, America is still where the action is. But I wouldn't say it's because of anything about innovation or anything like that.
We have the sense that the money's pretty deep in China. I mean, how much of the money that goes into this IPO, Alibaba's in New York, do you expect actually to come out of China, Gadi?
That's a good question. I'm sure that people will find their way to get their money out of China. Of course, many people have already gotten their money out of China, and they might put their investments into these companies. But more, there will be people who will make a lot of money in China out of these IPOs, and that money will be overseas for them to play with as they like.
Tom Doktoroff, how do you read the optics of Alibaba doing its IPO in the United States? There may be structural reasons, but does that look strange to Chinese users, potential investors there?
Not at all. The Chinese are ruthless pragmatists. And again, I very much agree with Gadi. It's really a question of where the money is and also where the transparency is. I think that Chinese do recognize that the U.S. markets are much more efficient and much more transparent than anything that would exist in China. And I think that that leads to another point, that for Chinese consumers and the relationship with the government, I think one thing that it has done is it's increased the transparency. It's not helping a democratic impulse, but it is still making the government more accountable to the Chinese consumers and vice versa. So when the Chinese talk about democracy, they don't mean representative democracy, but they mean efficient and responsive government. And I think in this sense, the government is benefiting from, and the people are benefiting from, the Chinese internet.
Lily Kuo in Hong Kong. Here's a listener raising another transparency issue on the business side. Ed writes to us on our website, says, I have a problem with Chinese companies listing on our stock exchanges. Accounting problems are a major problem. I lost big, he writes, with Shengda Tech, which inflated sales and revenues. Why would another Chinese company be any different, especially one where the access is controlled by government censors? What about financial transparency and Chinese companies listing in the U.S. stock exchange, Lily?
Well, I think that Chinese IPOs in the U.S. now do face a lot more scrutiny than they did. There was a whole batch of reverse IPOs that happened a few years ago and a lot of Chinese companies ended up having to delist because of a lot of financial issues and accounting issues. But I think that now you have companies, Chinese companies, that are trying to sort of become more transparent and trying to give U.S. regulators and U.S. officials more comfort with, you know, opening the market to Chinese companies. So you've got Huawei, also a big Chinese telecom firm that has been trying to get into the U.S., and they've been taking steps to try to make themselves seem more trustworthy. So I think the same thing Alibaba will be doing the same thing. I think there are a few, I'm not too clear on the regulatory side, but I think that because their accountant is in Hong Kong, they might be exempt from a few things that they have to disclose. But one thing that somebody has raised about downsides to Alibaba listing in the U.S. is that they will have to turn over a lot of information about the company and about the Chinese market. And in some ways, you could say that Alibaba does cooperate with the government, and there could be information that they turn over that Chinese officials don't want them to turn over. So in some ways, Alibaba is putting itself in between the U.S. government and the Chinese government.
Does that, Gadi, end up exporting more American-style accounting to China, or obfuscating, ultimately kind of diminishing that accounting standard because you got such a big company who may not observe it coming onto the Wall Street?
There's absolutely a concern about that, that the Chinese companies aren't being transparent enough. And that's true right up to the top of the Chinese internet. Duncan Clark, an expert here, called fraud caps, which is how he nicknamed these smaller companies that, like your caller, have had a problem with. I think are not an issue here. I mean, we're talking about big, well-known companies. Now, the censorship issue is an issue of concern in Weibo's case because they will continue to be affected by that Their bottom line
this
will
is the sort of Twitter
that.
Equivalent, and they're also looking to come for an American IPO.
Right. And so I think I would think that people who know a lot about Weibo are less excited about it than the average American investor. And this gets to part of the point why they're listing in the U.S. There's an excitement about the Chinese internet play, which has always been there. I mean, it was really big a few years ago, and it's a little bit less feverish now. But compared to the rest of the world market, China is still the exciting growth market, and especially the Chinese internet market. So I think that's yet another reason why you're seeing these companies list in the U.S.
This is where it pushes right up against politics and policy. We had the American First Lady, Michelle Obama, in China, just arrived a few days ago with the first daughters there. And here was Michelle Obama on Saturday speaking with students at the Stanford Center at Peking University in Beijing, saying technology has the power to, quoting her here, expose us to ideas and innovations we never could have imagined. That's already a little political in China. She went further.
That's why it's so important for information and ideas to flow freely over the internet and through the media, because that's how we discover the truth. That's how we learn what's really happening in our communities and our country and our world. And that's how we decide which values and ideas we think are best.
Michelle Obama in Beijing. Lily Kuo, does that read as highly political commentary from the American First Lady in China?
Well, yes, I think so, and I think that is likely the First Lady's only political comment, because that visit was touted as such a people-to-people diplomatic visit. Mm-hmm. And I think in a lot of ways, the Chinese internet sphere and media is becoming more free. But these companies, as Gadi was saying, this censorship will persist and it will affect their bottom line.
And there it is, Tiffany in Columbia, South Carolina. Tiffany, you're on.
Yes. Hi, Pat. Do you think the NSA spying on our own citizens and others throughout the country has helped the growth of these Chinese internet companies?
Good question. Tom Doctorow, let me bring that one to you. I mean, we had the most recent of these revelations out of the NSA from Edward Snowden, New York Times reporting that the NSA... we've already heard about the surveillance that they've done in the United States and around the world. This in particular, them going after the Huawei telecoms company that Lily Kuo mentioned, looking to get inside the products that they're manufacturing there for export that would put the NSA inside telecom systems all over the world. What about the pot calling the kettle black dynamic here? Does the U.S. still have a different standing, a different reputation? Certainly, the censorship at home is nothing like China's, but there's NSA surveillance, Tom.
Well, I think that from the Chinese perspective, every Chinese person is going to have a very suspicious view of any government. Conspiracy theories abound in China. And I think that the pot calling the kettle black is something that's quite natural. But I also believe that these are very independent things and not necessarily related, and doesn't really affect the dynamics of what's happening on China's internet scene or the commercial prospects of its largest companies.
You know, I want to talk for just a minute about something that's been very hot lately all over the world, but of course in China, number one, this was the disappearance of the Malaysian Airlines flight. The Malaysian government now saying that it's at the bottom of the Indian Ocean. A lot of Chinese still not happy with that answer. But also along the way, and Gadi, let me bring this to you, I'm looking here at reporting about Chinese, first of all, looking to control the news about this very emotional loss of the airplane. It had two-thirds of the passengers China. Of course, it was headed from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. Quoting here, this is the New Republic I'm reading. On March 8th, the Central Propaganda Department sent out a directive to Chinese journalists and bloggers, quote, "The media may not independently analyze or comment on the lost Malaysian Airlines flight. Related coverage must strictly accord with the authoritative information issued by the Civil Aviation Administration of China and with Xinhua News Agency Wirecopy, the government news service there." That is an unimaginable government directive in this country, Gadi. Are Chinese internet companies providing a forum for Chinese citizens to object to that top-down news management?
Well, I mean, in their own way, they can comment on the news, and some of that some of those comments get censored and some don't. Not, you know, some things make it through, certainly not everything is censored. This just reveals, you know, or exposes what is one of the first interests of the Chinese government when any sort of serious disaster like this happens, which is to make sure that speculation doesn't run wild and that emotions run high and turn something into a potential for a mass incident out in the real world. They don't want a movement. They don't want anything to – they want to contain the response to a disaster. And so they've allowed some propaganda and, in fact, encouraged some propaganda that's directed at Malaysia as its bumbling has continued. And that sort of satisfies the domestic audience. But what they don't want is people rallying in the streets. There was a minor demonstration today by the families as they made their way to the Malaysian embassy in Beijing looking for answers. But that was controlled, and it was, to the extent that it was tolerated at all, it was unusual. But that's very minor by comparison to what they're worried about.
I mean, here we've got a Weibo user. They're, again, kind of Twitter equivalent, quoted in the same piece, saying, "Why doesn't the Chinese media have the power to report exclusive information, comparing it unfavorably to the American media, which has broken more stories here?" Here's another Weibo comment. This was on translated here by Boston.com, saying, "America," this is a Weibo commenter in China, "America probably already knows the truth." Now, I don't know if they mean the NSA or the FBI or regular American citizens, but some envy of American openness there. And then this story, Lily Kuo in Hong Kong, the reporting here that one Weibo user, their Twitter again, from Hainan in the south, guessed that the airplane, the Malaysian aircraft, had entered a secret undersea vessel as part of a terrorist plot to attack the city of Sanya. He, this commenter online, was reportedly given a 10-day jail sentence. I mean, that's reaching right down to take one little kind of imaginative speculator, Lily, and reportedly put him in jail. That sounds like a very different relationship with internet use. If you put Americans in jail for online speculation, our prison population would explode further.
Yeah, you know, I think this is actually one of the reasons why Chinese internet users, why their habits are very different from those in other countries, because one of the things that happens is that information can't really be trusted because it's so controlled at the top. And it's also, you know, controlled by a company that's releasing information about its products and all kinds of things. And that's why even, you know, from everything from information about a plane being lost to public health issues or safety of products or the actual use of a product, all of that information can't really be trusted. And so that makes Chinese internet users and consumers very different in how they buy things and how they review things and talk about things.
Tom Doctoroff, so much of the original innovation happened in the United States. Now the internet is morphing and going off in new directions in China. It's such a large market. It's going to have tremendous throw weight. Do you see, a lot of this will be global, but to the extent that it's national, do you see the United States and Chinese internet worlds developing as different universes apart from one another? How much will they continue to affect each other? Will we have two different beasts that emerge here? Very different internet?
I think we will have different beasts, and that's for a variety of reasons. One is the Great Firewall, which we were just talking about. But secondly, I also think that the relationship that Chinese people have with the internet and Western people have with the internet is quite different. In a nutshell, the Western relationship is much more functional, is much more practical, is much more rooted in trust. And I think in China, it's much more emotional. It's much more about self-expression. It's much more about release. For example, if you take some of the emoticons that are such big business in China, and with some of the messaging systems like WeChat or group chatting, you know, it's because people want to express how they feel that they can't normally do in an offline world. When people go onto the internet and engage in all things digital, it's really a blank canvas of self-expression, and that need is not nearly so transient in the United States. So a lot of the things that people are willing to pay for in America are different than the things people are willing to pay for in China. Even if you take a look at e-commerce didn't really take off in China until very quintessentially Chinese needs for reassurance in terms of Alipay, in terms of money-back guarantees and the 2 weeks to kick the tires and test the merchandise, until all of these very Chinese needs were satisfied. So I think that the Chinese internet is a distinctly Chinese beast.
Gotti, just half a minute here. Who's going to guide the ship of the internet? Or is there one ship globally as we go forward here? Will it be Chinese-flavored or American-flavored?
I think there'll be many ships. China is setting a model for some authoritarian countries to have their own internet. So they have their national internet. America has its, which some Western countries enjoy their own versions of. But there will be some authoritarian countries who'd like to build a Chinese internet.
With some big, fat connections, not least Alibaba going public in the United States, if Tom Doktoroff is right, that emotional relationship means watch the Chinese internet. That emotion means volatility. We'll look at that over time as well. So grateful to the three of you for being with us today. Tom Doktoroff in Shanghai with J. Walter Thompson. Tom, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Gotti Epstein in Beijing with The Economist. A giant cage is his headline. Gotti, thank you for being here.
Great to be with you, Tom.
And Lily Kuo in Hong Kong with Quartz. Thanks to you all three. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're out of time. This is On Point. Thanks, Lily.